yourself, because you know, you think you know, but you don't know, and it's more likely that with complacency you won't take a jump across a river or something metaphoric that's going to stress you. So pain, they say, is inevitable, suffering is optional, and pain really is fear. So the Buddhists say that they are the ultimate hedonists. They are about true happiness, true joy, whereas for most of us it's transient, it's to do with entertainment and transient satisfaction related to the ego. And the Buddha talked about the four rivers of suffering, the suffering of illness, the suffering of aging, and we can't control those. These are the uncontrolled sufferings. But if you're an advanced Buddhist and you have an advanced practice, you can control your attitude to aging and sickness. Now, you can't control death, but you can certainly control some aspects of dying and be prepared about that. We're going to talk about that as well. To the extent you can control death and what you're going to do and not fear it, you will have a more pleasant crossing over. And right, though you can't control where you're going to be reborn again, that depends on your karma. You know, bodhisattvas practice in such a way that they pray and meditate in order to inherit the next life where they can carry on their practice at a higher level, or even better still, they can go to the pure land of perfected beings. So pain is inevitable, but you know, we don't have to suffer. Now, fear of death, you can read the quote yourself. Fear of death is really about preparation during life. What one wants to do with some control over death and not fear it is to go into a kind of an existential free fall without any fear, without any attachment, and go to the right vibration and see the light and hear the ancestors or your guides calling you up your home. So if you look at folks who've had near-death experiences, they don't fear death anymore. They almost don't want to come back. And, you know, they're forced to come back. They're told, your time is not ready yet, you need to come back, and they do. But they don't fear death again. There were also experiments done by Stanislav Grof in the 1960s with LSD, and he found that a lot of people that took LSD lost their fear of death because they were able to visualize these alternative realities. The ancestors say we live in a 1% world, and near-death experience allows us to see something more than the 1%. Ever since I'm wearing a mask, my voice doesn't last as long as it used to, so I'll be sipping every now and again. There have also been experiments now with psilocybin. That's an entheogen, a mind-altering substance found in magic mushrooms, been used by psychiatrists and research now. It's condoned by the FDA. And they found that it's very useful for refractory depression, anxiety, but a lot of the people who use it as well stop fearing death. Shamans, especially the Bushmen and advanced Buddhists, have mastered death. The Bushmen actually have what's called a little death experience by going to the spirit world and then coming back, not losing track of their silver cord that connects the soul to the body. So in reality, we can prepare our karma for death and we can really have a pleasant crossing. Death should be something we can look forward to. Essentially, you're just moving house. But the main thing is you can't take anything with you. You're going out of one door through another door into a much bigger space of a 99% world, which is kind of very compelling. Now, what about a threat to health, and that's life, limb, organ, or function? And this is also a tremendous fear that many of us face, and hope is here for sure. If you look at these problems and you look at really severe illnesses, there are three variables to this that need to pay attention to. The one is the healer and the healer's team, that of course includes the physician, but it goes far beyond the physician. And the healer and the healer's team are responsible for placebo effect. That's the power of belief, which is love, to help, to heal, or to even cure you. And not invoking a nocebo effect, which is the opposite, the power of belief to hurt, harm, possibly even kill you. So the team has a very, very important task to do in always giving hope. Then the second variable is the patient. The patient's inner healer is profoundly powerful. It can do almost anything. It's made in the image of the divine. It's part of the soul. And as you'll see when patients have spontaneous remissions of deadly diseases, the inner healer is paramount. It actually gets rid of something that Western medicine couldn't get rid of. So it's important for the patient to enhance the power of the inner healer, the life force, with any method possible, meditation, acupuncture, Reiki. You know, there's a Sufi saying that says, tie your, trust in God, but tie your camel. We have to do our part. We have to tie our camel, and then the inner healer will work for us. The patient, to some extent, can control the place. In other words, if you have a dysfunctional family life, maybe some resolution can be done with that. Or a toxic work environment, you can maybe take a leave of absence. And if you have access to alternative methods of healing, especially to nature, the healing is going to be much more powerful. To the extent that the patient and the healing team can access the field, the unknowable part of the field, the 99%, the ancestors, the guides, the creator, whatever you want to call it, to the extent that they can both access that realm, the healing is going to be powerful, more powerful. So there's a lot we can do about sickness. On the left you have a love vibration, which you could call a eustress, a good stress, finding meaning in the stress. On the other side you have fear or distress. And placebo and nocebo work directly on the inner healer through the belief system on the inner healer. In other words, we know that we've been hexed by the nocebo, or we know we've been encouraged by the placebo effect of a physician. But the important thing to recognize is that there's a field effect as well, and it works whether you know about it or not, or whether you believe in it or not. So there are now numerous double-blind studies showing that if you take two groups of patients, the one gets standard care, the other one gets standard care, plus healing from a distance from healers they don't know, and they don't even know they're being healed, so there's no placebo effect. The results were so much better with the healing group that if it was a pill, you could bottle it and give it to the patient, you'd be negligent really not to give it. I can assure you that if distant healing works, distant hexing also works, and it works more powerfully with the nocebo effect. For instance, if you're an indigenous person and you believe in nocebo and you know you've been hexed, the power of a hex plus nocebo can be extremely powerful. Even more so if you have reason that they've hexed you. For instance, if you screwed somebody over in business, you're going to feel that you deserve to be hexed in a sense. It can be almost as good as a death sentence in some of these cases. The same is true with some religious people who have convictions that God is punishing them with a disease. That's not the way a disease works. But it's going to be much more difficult for them to be healed because they almost feel they deserve not to be well. Is this better? Everybody hear me now? Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay, there are some healing outcomes here. There's remission. And the good news is I don't recognize Western medicine since the millennium. I'm just hearing more and more reports of people with deadly diseases who 20 years ago I would say was no hope that are being cured. So remission is more and more possible. And relapse now is quite handleable in terms of there's so many new things out there coming every day to you and to us that can get you out of a relapse into remission. So there's tremendous amount of hopes, of course, if you have access to really the best medicine. We still get fulminating progression and death. That happens if in a misdiagnosis or delayed diagnosis, for instance with COVID, I'm sure this happened quite a lot. Spontaneous remission of disease, I want to talk a little bit about, because it's just as important for spiritual healing, spiritual transformation, as it is for bodily healing, so it's relevant to anything that you're doing here. And everybody can be healed, but they're not necessarily going to be cured. A lot of people are cured and not healed, and they go on with their dysfunction to maybe inherit another disease or some other problem that will get them in another way. So in the 1990s, two books came out from Noetic Sciences about the work done at Lourdes with the Vatican Medical Commission, that was appointed to study patients who had spontaneous healing of deadly diseases. I think they documented 67 of them when I last looked. Now, this is not that unusual, because there are a lot of people we don't hear about. The doctors will, of course, say that it's anecdotal, but they've gone to a Qigong master or a psychic healer or a shaman, and they've been healed from a disease that should not have been healed, and Western medicine failed. And if you look at these properties, that they're really important, because they have to do with everything we do, not just with healing. What they found is these people feared less. They had the will to live, they had a fighting spirit, they had unfulfilled goals they wanted to realize. They trusted in the medical team, they trusted in themselves and the people around them and their inner healer. They had faith or a spiritual belief. This is not necessarily a religious one. It was for the Christians who went to Lourdes, but often it was translated into, I just knew I was going to be well. I just knew I would be okay. It's an inner feeling. We can work on the rest of these, but that one you can't really work on. You've either got it or you don't have it. Love and a support system, either as a loving spouse or family or community, even a pet or support group, is very important. Again, love is always the juice. Choice, perceiving the patient only as a partner and vice versa. The physician and the team recognizing that the patient can do lots of things that can help him or her. And they would endorse them, encourage them, unlike some doctors I know who tell their patients, this is all nonsense, it's not proven, you're wasting your money, you're wasting your time. That's a nocebo effect. Finding meaning in the predicament. This was actually very prevalent. A lot of them said they would never have chosen to have the disease, but having had it, they were very grateful for what it brought to them. They were not the same person. They went through a hero or heroine's journey. Many had a prior rite of passage, so if you climb Everest once, it's going to be more easy the next time. And they avoided stress at all costs, you know, they, to the point of being very selfish, but their point was not being selfish, it was to be well so they could be more for other people. I think that's a problem for a lot of folks. So this is kind of like a miracle. These are 67 cases that were designated miracles by the Vatican. Fear of having no meaning. I love this quote by Lawrence van der Post, who actually was godfather to the current King Charles. And I think we can have a lot of hope for Charles, because he's very pro-environment. Maybe he can make a difference to what's going on the planet. But he said, once what you are living and what you are doing has for you meaning, it is irrelevant whether you are happy or unhappy. You are content. You are not alone in your spirit. You belong. So it's not as if you're bouncing off the walls with joy and happiness because you found meaning. Often life becomes more difficult. You know, you've got more work to do and so on. But you feel okay. You feel like you're in harmony, that you're in one with yourself. So we need to look at that because this is a very important one. And it's never too late. So if you look at the lack of meaning, this is especially prevalent if you look at people who survived the Nazi death camps. And Viktor Frankl was one. He wrote a book, you know, A Man's Quest for Meaning. And he said, striving to find meaning in life is the primary, most powerful motivating and driving force in humans. What he also discovered was the way the folks imagined the future was how they could survive. A lot of them had somebody they wanted to, a loved one they wanted to meet up with, or they wanted to write a book, or they helped others, they found meaning in helping others. It was the way they imagined the future. And it often wasn't the strongest physically who survived, it was often those you wouldn't expect to survive. The ones who had difficulty with what I like acronyms, they had the HAD, the H-A-D, they already think they had it. Hopeless, helpless, head down, anxious, apathetic, depressed, dejected, desperate, always in despair, and detached from the reality of their situation, resigned to their fate. Many of them threw themselves up against the electric wires and killed themselves. So it's interesting that if you look at folks like Mandela and Gandhi, they prevailed because they had a mission, they had meaning. In spite of all the hardships they went through, they held to their vision. So this is a very important part of our life. So
Thurman was also a devout Buddhist, or is a devout Buddhist, and he said, don't ask what the world needs. Ask yourself what makes you come alive, and then go do that. What the world needs is people who have come alive. Now, if you look at Seligman, who's, you know, sort of the father of positive psychology, I know, I'm sure Spencer's talked to you a lot about him. He talks about getting into your core strength or signature strength and doing it for something much bigger than yourself. He says accomplishment is okay, but it's all about giving it back, giving it away. So finding your core or signature strength is part of the hero's journey, which we'll touch on. I've got a talk coming up next month on more details about that. But when you find your core strength and you take your suffering, you make something useful out of it, you heal and you find meaning. And it also happens if it's something that you're really good at, you'll have the sense of flow, of fluidity, maybe even superfluidity, and what they call getting into the zone, which is kind of unique. So I want to take about fear of not taking a leap of faith, which is combined not only with the hero's journey, but with the warrior's journey as well. This is confronting the deep, the dark, and the steep. Many of you have had many, many warrior's journeys, which maybe could have been hero's journeys if you took your core strength, your signature strength that came out of that, and you used it to help others rather than what we all do. We end up doing what we need to do to survive, or what our parents told us to survive. So the heroine's journey that I want to talk about is really more of a spiritual one today. And the Upanishads say, may the hero awaken from forgetfulness. May the hero awaken from forgetfulness and transcend all anxiety and sorrow. So what he's talking about here is the forgetfulness. We know a lot more than we think we know. And we are much more than we believe ourselves to be. If we could tap into the positive aspects of our stored consciousness in our past lives, we would be able to remember a lot of stuff that we learned in those past lives. And those things can still come back to us as a sense of deja vu or familiarity. You might have a complex concept that Spencer's talking to you about, and somehow it rings a bell. You're familiar. You've already got it. You've grasped it. Whereas somebody else who's maybe a younger soul wouldn't necessarily understand it as rapidly. So this is what he means by awaken from forgetfulness and transcend anxiety and sorrow, because when we begin to work on our spiritual life, these things come back to us. You're all old souls here. You wouldn't be here if you weren't old souls. There's a lot of stuff that you can remember and become more of who you are now. And all this is more about what the ancestors call becoming more of who we are, or self-realization, if you like. So fear of leaving one's metaphoric safe harbor. The first stage of the hero's journey is separation. So there's a yearning for the extraordinary. You're really not happy with yourself anymore. You decided to hell with it. I'm going to take a risk and sort of jump off the cliff. There's a lot of fear. All three stages of the hero's journey, that's the separation, the threshold, which is the journey itself, the incorporation or the integration of it. They're all faced with fear, some more than for others. So first, the separation phase. Second, you go through the threshold, and Campbell says, the cave you fear to enter holds the treasure you seek. This is the maybe your physical fears, as opposed to what Jung is talking about, the meeting of one's shadow, which are more your psychological, emotional, and spiritual fears. Both of them are important. But when you go on this journey, which is like a deep a dark night of the soul, usually something comes out of it. It could be that you get a kick in the pants and you're forced on the journey by an illness or a death or something like that. Some of us require that. But if you do it voluntarily, you often get, if not a grail, then a kind of an aha experience, which I might just call a core strength or signature strength, that might help you in terms of what we're going to do with the rest of our lives in terms of helping people. Because karmically, that's what we are responsible for. We kind of are here to help others. So that's the threshold phase. You come back with this, if you like, signature strength, and you decide you're going to incorporate it. Now, the difficult thing is to hold to the vision, to be true to your myth. The one, I think, overriding factor is to keep your spiritual practice active, which will help you keep the aha experience or maybe even the grail. Most of us have a fall. I remember the inward bound trips I did, people had enlightening experiences, and when I would meet them 5 years later, they were pretty much the same as they were before. They hadn't really then had a hero's journey, but they'd turned it into a warrior's journey and they'd just gone back into their old lives. So it's very good if you can look at your warrior's journeys and see what came out of those, and maybe you lost something along the way which now you can use. You may not need to go on another new hero's journey in a sense. So the fall can occur for many reasons. The one reason is what's called the Peter Principle. We rise up to the level of our own incompetence, which means that cream rises to the top and then it gets sour. So if you take the example of, say, a brilliant teacher, and say she's incredible, her students love her, she's happy at home, the board loves her, the dean loves her, and they say, well, you know, we're going to lose her unless we promote her, or somebody's going to grab her, and, you know, the dean's about to retire, why don't we make her the dean? So they take her, brilliant teacher, inner core strength, and they bring her into the office and they say, look, we're going to give you a great salary, a retirement plan, better health care, you'll have your own office, you'll have a budget, you'll have your own parking space. Well, what are you going to say? No, most people are going to say yes. So she leaves her lane, and she goes into a lane where she's lost her sense of competence, her sense of flow, and she falls, and she's not happy, her family's not happy, and so on. So sometimes that's the problem. We get bought out of our core strength, out of our destiny, by expediency, and it's very easy for us all to do that. Now, threat to the ego, or the small self. I'm not going to talk so much about that, except for the expedition things that I was talking about, where people are worried about the ego more than about dying. But I want to talk a little bit about shame. Now I'm out of my lane a bit, because most of you know a lot more than I do about it. Certainly Spencer, I'm sure, is an expert. But I do deal with it in my divination practice. It comes up a lot. We're talking about a shattered ego now. Fear of shame. Shame is a swampland of the soul, Jung said. It's a crippling emotional force. And, you know, we all have stuff we feel we regret or we have remorse for, or maybe a little bit of guilt, a little bit of shame because of what we did or what we didn't do, what we could have done better, or maybe what was done to us that we didn't stand up for ourselves for. We all have that. But regret and remorse are often feeling bad about what we did. Whereas shame, especially toxic shame, and sometimes guilt, are feeling bad about who we are. And feeling bad about who you are, self-condemnation strengthens that feeling, and it leads to a negative spiral, a feedback mechanism. Humiliation is often associated with it, and it's a major threat to one's ego. So toxic shame is a breaking of the self, the small self, the ego self, a shattering of the self. In guilt and lesser amounts of shame, the self can still be intact. And you know, we can always make amends, we can reconcile, we can forgive ourselves, forgive others, ask forgiveness. There's always a way we can fix those. But toxic shame is a little bit more difficult to handle. And it doesn't apply to most of us here, but Brené Brown says it's very prevalent, and it's like 60% of the American population, at least. And I think that's my experience as well. So the only way out of it is through it. One has to own it, embrace it, and use the shit and turn it into manure, basically. And that's, you know, profoundly possible. Raw says that if we do not transform our pain, we will most assuredly transmit it. So if people have been abused either very early on in life or later on in life, they often turn inwards to themselves in terms of maybe self-mutilation, maybe even suicidal ideation, or they turn their anger and their hatred and their malice outwards towards others. So you can't, you know, you've got to get it out there. And Brown says the voice of shame is invisibility, silence, secrecy, and self-judgment. So one has to sort of come out of hiding, come out of the closet, and it can be incredibly powerfully healing. So to err is human, to forgive divine, we all screw up, we all do bad things, it doesn't make us bad. To be vulnerable is to be courageous. And the courage to be imperfect will cause compassion and forgiveness with most people. Maybe not everybody, but most people will admire it. So we need not to get stuck in damaging self-talk and self-blame. And this puts the prefrontal lobe in lockdown mode. You sort of go into survival mode, and that's not a good thing. Being a good friend to oneself, the answer to say release yourself from what you're not accountable, shift the blame to where it belongs, and you know it's going to require many kinds of treatment, including maybe a rehabilitation program where other people are sharing their stories and you feel much better about yours. Maybe your story is not as bad as theirs is. And I'm sure I know a lot of folks get recovery from this kind of help. So fear of isolation, I'm moving right along here. But Mother Teresa said the greatest pain on earth is not the pain of poverty and hunger, but the feeling of isolation. I'm sure she found this out when she was in India, and she noticed that people, maybe 10 people living in a room, all sleeping on the floor, at poverty level, not having enough to eat, but they were all there for each other. So they were not isolated, they had each other, and that was hugely powerful. When my first visit to the Bushmen of the Kalahari, I visited these people living in the desert situation. They don't even have access to water, at least at that stage they didn't. They got their water from roots and tubers and so on, or sometimes from rain that they might store in ostrich eggs. They were happier than I was when they had nothing, because they had a small clan. It was one for all for one. They would share their last bit of food with each other. And they were all happy, in fact, incredibly happy. They also had a profound spiritual identity as well. And the Bantu neighbors, the Bushmen, are not the same as the Bantu neighbors in Southern Africa, the Zulus and the different tribes. And Bishop Tutu has talks about the concept, the African concept of Ubuntu. Ubuntu, he says, is you are only a person through other persons. I am only a person through another person. Thich Nhat Hanh said we inter are. I mean, we are all inseparable. We create duality when there shouldn't be any created. The ancestors say, you know, we are all one, not the same. All of us, dust to dust, ashes to ashes. And Roshi said the fundamental delusion of humanity is believe that I am here and you are out there. You know, that's what screws everything up. So I have a feeling, I don't have any experience of this, I don't have any data to prove it, but I think a lot of Americans are isolated because of this profound feeling of individuality. You know, reliance on others, I think for some Americans implies dependency and debt, and they don't like that. And they expect the same is true of somebody else, so they don't often offer a helping hand because they don't want to insult the person by offering something that maybe they can do on their own. They always come to the fore when things are desperate, I think more than anybody else. They're incredibly generous when things get, you know, really, really hard. But I think the Lone Ranger mentality, which was very compelling even when I grew up in South Africa and I would watch cowboy movies, this idea of the cowboy on his horse, you know, with a six gun and a rifle and a bedroll and enough food, going out into the wilderness all on his own, was pretty compelling, you know, at that stage. I think that still captivates a lot of us here as well. And I think it's embraced by Paul Simon's song, I'm a rock, I am an island, and a rock feels no pain, and an island never cries. So that is antithetical to any indigenous society. Everything is done in community. They die in community, they heal in community, they help each other. And I think this causes a lot of misery, even in spite of social media, where you can have thousands of friends, but none of them are real. And a lot of them you had nothing to do with if you met them in real time. So we'll talk a little bit about how we can remedy this isolation. Fear and threat to the soul or the higher self. By this I'm talking about soul sickness or soul loss, which are usually results from kind of the things I've been talking about. So I'm going to have to put this thing down, I think. But the ancestors say, they quote David the psalmist, I got my two hands together. From the sound of my sighing has my essence cleaved unto my flesh. So the sighing on my right hand is my soul. The flesh is my body. The flesh and the body and the soul should be one. And when we have the sound of the sighing, that's a sound of equanimity, what Spence induced on you when you did the meditation. From the sound of your sighing in the meditation, your essence, your soul cleaves onto your flesh, your body. That's the state we should all be in. The soul is pure, the soul is made in the image of God. But the body is not. The body is not pure. It's vulnerable to sentient pleasures. We are here to sort of enjoy life and enjoy it responsibly. And when we don't enjoy it responsibly, the soul tends to separate at least partially from the body, kind of in disgust. If it checks out completely, then that's what you call soul loss. So if you look at the causes of soul sickness or soul loss, soul loss comes from severe abuse, satanic cults, Boko Haram, ISIS, those people, the Mexican drug cartels and gangs. What do? Part of the initiation process is to go and kill some innocent person, and you're seeing it even here today. I'm sure a lot of these murders we're hearing about, some guy gets stabbed for no good reason, is part of a Mexican drug cartel initiation ceremony. When you've killed somebody, you've murdered somebody like that, you almost will become unredeemable. Your soul gets lost, very, very hard to bring it back. You always can be redeemed, but it's not going to be that easy. And once they've done that to you, they have you, because you know, you'll want to stay with them. Not only that, you might get possessed by other spirits, not of your liking. To lesser forms like trauma, violence, war, addiction, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, burnout, severe illness, spiritual disease. These are more to do with soul sickness, not so much soul loss. That's much more easily fixed, more easily remedied. But any of the things we talked about before can cause some degree of soul sickness. Shame can actually cause soul loss if it becomes too severe. So I think we're doing okay in terms of time. I wanted to do a little meditation at the end, but I want to talk about the unknown, the occult, religious, and superstitious. A lot of people are a bit like death. They don't want to talk about these things because they don't want to know that they're real, that they are real. I'm not going to talk about religious and superstitious, no burning in hell and damnation because you misbehave. That's a whole other subject that I'm not interested in really. But I'm talking about the occult, the unknown. And we're very happy to encounter the occult in mythology and in some of the movies like Star Wars or Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter. That's great, we can go there, we can be entertained, but try and believe that that stuff is partly real, even though it may be in metaphor. Nobody wants to believe that, and I think that's one of the big fears that we have. I know, and especially the one concerning witchcraft, I must say that people tend to get freaked out when I talk about witchcraft. So I'm going to talk about what I learned from the Sambhormas, and these are spiritual diseases that are unknown to allopathic medicine and to psychiatry, and I would say even to Jungian psychology. They are spiritual. There's no amount of medicine or psychotherapy is going to help it or get rid of it. It might help a bit, but it's not going to get rid of it. So withdrawal of your spirit guides, of your ancestors, is really a sin of omission. It's not commission. You haven't done anything wrong. You just forget them. You don't pay any attention to them, and they can't be of assistance to you. Because in order to embrace your ancestors and get them to help you, you have to ask to receive. Free will is the cosmic law. They cannot help you unless you ask. So you have to find some way of asking them. You have to develop a relationship, even though you can't see them, hear them, feel them. You've got to know they're there, then they will help you, even unknowingly. Many of you have been probably saved by your guides at some stage, but you thought, oh my goodness, that was close, something saved me. you're going on the freeway, you're about to turn into the wrong lane, and for some reason you don't, and there's a Big Mac truck going by that would have taken you out completely. That's the kind of thing that ancestors do, but they don't get credit for it. If you have an ancestor practice, and you acknowledge them and you show gratitude, you can nurture the relationship and you can have a lot more better things happening in your life. I don't have time to talk about all of these. But there are two kinds of spiritual intrusions. One are earthbound spirits. Those are spirits that are stuck between the worlds and usually from a traumatic or a sudden or a confused death. The commonest one would be a little old lady who died in her house and now is wandering around the hallways, haunting the house. There's nothing good about being haunted, even though that she's benign and she doesn't mean any harm. It gets in the way of your energy, in the way of your aura. Nothing good about that. The other one that's really important are the spiritual intrusions that are on the other side of the veil, who are seeking forgiveness. They're seeking release from the sins of the past. They might have abused you or somebody in their previous life severely, and not necessarily sexually or physically, but emotionally as well. The laws up there are much more strict than they are down here. So they often haunt the living in order to get their attention so that they can be forgiven. Because if you're forgiven from that karmic sin, you are released from that karmic implication. You can come back in a slightly better reincarnation. You don't have to go and repeat the whole thing all over again and be challenged with the same things that you were challenged with before. So the dead often haunt the living. So I'll talk a bit about ritual impurity or energetic pollution and tonglen and witchcraft and sorcery. But all of these, to a greater or less extent, can cause dis-ease, which can eventually create disease. And it'll manifest in different ways: anxiety, depression, bad luck, trouble with relationships, trouble at work because you're angry, you don't know what's making you angry and you don't respond correctly to people. And some of them, like I say, are worse than others. But when you get rid of it, it goes away, and you often can have somatic complaints like headache or neck pain. It often attacks your weaker system, GI complaint, if you have a weak gut, and anxiety, depression can all be part of it. So it's really important. So any of them can do this to you, and ritual impurity included, but this is more of a localized thing. Ritual impurity, I'm only going to talk about a few things, but it's also concerning people who are dealing with death a lot, and also to deal with the impurities of blood, but I won't deal with that because it doesn't sort of apply here. But objects are an important thing. Often I deal with people who've got these demonic masks from Africa on their wall or from New Guinea, and they don't know where they're from, they're often old, they don't know who used them, what they were used for. And they will carry the energy of what happened at that time, even though the spirit might be gone. The same is true for certain places that you go to visit. Like somebody might want to go and visit Auschwitz because of some reason. Probably not a good idea unless you're very tough, because you're going to pick up on the energetic pollution of that place, not to mention maybe earthbound spirits that are hanging around that area. So these are really important things that people sometimes ignore. Military objects are another one that carry energy. If something from the Civil War that might have killed somebody, or an old samurai sword or something like that. You want to be careful that you have, if you have anything like that around. Also, sickness can be energetically polluting. You know, if you've been in the hospital for weeks in ICU and the rehab, when you come out, you need a detox. It doesn't have to be spiritual. It can be just a decent detox and a good spa, because you're not the same as you were when you were well. Those are the ones that really concern you, but you should also be wary of places where satanic rituals have been done, or a Native American burial ground where atrocities have occurred. In South Africa, where apartheid atrocities occurred, there are places there you don't want to go near, and you certainly don't want to buy them. So be careful of places. If there's water in the place, I'm sure a lot of you know that water has memory. It'll hold the energy. If there's water there, it's very unlikely you're going to be able to cleanse the place. Sometimes the places can be cleansed, but it's better to not go there. Tonglen is a very commendable practice, which is the idea of breathing in the pain and suffering of the universe or other people, converting it into positive, loving energy, and then breathing it out to the person or persons that you want to heal. And the ancestors say be very careful of this unless you're very advanced in your Buddhist practice. It's far better for you to breathe in white light of the universe and breathe that out as love and healing to the rest of the people. Don't take on anybody else's suffering. We've got enough of our own these days. Witchcraft or sorcery. Now, this is something people don't like to believe in. In fact, I know most white people in South Africa, when you talk to them, they say, witchcraft and sorcery only work if you believe in it. If you don't believe in it, it doesn't work. In other words, a nocebo effect. Well, that's not true. Witchcraft and sorcery come from a heart of envy, from somebody who wants something that you've got, who wants to prevent you from having that, because they either have an evil eye, an evil tongue, an evil inclination. Many people have those kind of inclinations anyway, but you wouldn't call them a witch or a sorcerer. But in some ways they can be quite powerful because they've given permission to forces that are outside of them that they may not even be aware of to maybe send the evil eye to somebody else at work, which creates a problem with that person at work. So these things are real. A witch, of course, and I'm talking about not Wicca, not the light side of Wicca, but the dark occult side of witchcraft. These are professionals who have consciously conscripted dark forces, sometimes I call them the spiritual mafia, to help them in their work, and they can be extremely powerful. The good news is that love prevails over fear, so there's nothing I'm talking about that cannot be corrected. Now, this is not going to affect most people in this audience, but it might affect some of the clients that you visit or come to see you, where you're not having any luck with your therapy. You might have to go and, we've got somebody who does past life regression. It could be part of their store consciousness. Are you sitting there? Put up your hand. And so these are things you really need additional help with, and shamanic kind of help or otherwise. Okay, so here are the things we talked about. So the death, is a near-death experience place, society, not only here but all over the United States, where you can go on a Wednesday, you can listen to people with inspiring stories of their near-death experience, which may help you educate yourself about these things. Health, we've already talked about, think about the variables, think how you can help people with prayer, what you can do for people that are ailing, prayer for yourself. If you're going to pray for yourself, it's good to get yourself out of the way and pray for the greater good, so that when you're better, you're going to do something good about what's happened to you for the sake of other people. Fear of taking a leap of faith, you may not want to do this, but at least scrutinize your previous warrior's journeys and see if you can find a core strength, a secondary strength that you can use that maybe you've neglected because your parents told you to be an engineer and you really wanted to play the guitar. Go out and play the guitar in an Irish pub or something like that. Finding meaning is taking a leap of faith, looking at the warrior's and the hero's journeys, maybe even taking a hero's or a heroine's journey again. Shame and humiliation is going to require extra help, but the main thing is to come out of hiding. Isolation, find community. You can find a community by going on a search for the self. That's what a lot of folks here are doing. Jung said the search for the self is at the core of all human motivation, whether we know about it or not. That's the real self, the true self, the higher self. So you can find community with a like-minded group of people on that quest, or you can find community in helping others and joining some sort of a society where you can use your core strength. I would say for the occult, just be aware of it because it's not going to affect you normally, but it might, so you never know. You will be surprised how many people I see who don't even think of, they don't even know about witchcraft, and they, in a sense, they have been hexed to a minor extent. Soul sickness and soul loss are really a result of some of these things as well as some other things that we talked about. And then fear the known. You know, now it's time maybe to take your boat out of the safe harbor and see what else you can find for yourself. So I just want to mention something else which I've ignored, which I think is prevalent with all of us now, is all the stuff that's going around which is giving us all stress, anxiety, distress, PTSD, and it's real and it sort of seems to be ongoing. So we have climate change, you know, we have concerns with either too much water or no water. You know, California's running dry and it doesn't sound like anybody's doing anything about it. The Kogi in Colombia say that they're a tribe who say they were here to save the planet. They say it begins with the water, and they're right. When we fix the water situation, the animals will come back, the insects will come back, the bees will come back, we'll come back, the plants will come back. We've got to fix the water situation in some way or another. Now, these are big things that none of us here can really do, but at least we can do something about it. You know, there's the threat of another pandemic, the fact that COVID hasn't really gone away, look how we are now. There's war, you know, there's crazy Putin now threatening nuclear catastrophe, and there's these zealots that are out there with these crazy conspiracy theories that are really worrying. So we can't do enough about these things, although some of you can, you know, just look Patagonia did. They just gave their whole company over to survival of the planet. There are people like that maybe we can go and help or something. The things we can do is, I would say, self-care. Have a spiritual practice. If you don't have one, practice gratitude. Gratitude is a spiritual practice. You can look it up. There's a lot of interesting work, psychological work, that's been done on gratitude. Practice random acts of kindness. If you can't find your core strength or a place to go and put your signature strength, practice random acts of kindness, even if you know maybe the person doesn't deserve it. It's not for you to judge. If some hobo is on the street, maybe reach out. Even if he's going to take your money and buy alcohol, that's his problem, not yours. I would urge you to go to nature. You know, we have incredible stuff here. It's a little bit dry out there at the moment and a little bit hot, but walk the beach or, you know, work in the garden or go to a park, or those that are more adventurous, you know, you can hike the front country or even backpack the back country. So I think I'm going to stop there. I want to do a little meditation before we take questions. Are we okay for time? Great. So it's just a song. I get these songs in my dreams. I'm not a musician, but the ancestors insist that I sing them. And I've got a brilliant musician in South Africa who helps me a lot. Otherwise, they wouldn't be what they sound like. And this one is just to encourage you. I've got a lot of Celtic Druid guides, and they intended to send me these things. And the one I'm going to play here is Patrick Shield. So if you can sit up straight and close your eyes and take some deep breaths in, breathe in white light of what you want to embrace from the talk, and breathe out the thick black smoke of anything you feel you need to get rid of that's causing fear in your life. And you can, if you don't want to do that, you can read the quotes. They're pretty profound. And this is just an endorsement for nature, the big medicine that can really help you. If you just go for a walk on the beach with all the crap that's going on, you're going to feel better, but you're going to do it almost daily, sometimes twice a day. So just relax, breathe in white light, and breathe out the thick black smoke, and see where you go. I rise to bathe.
Depth of the sea.